The following podcast is a production of Institutional Real Estate Incorporated. For the most comprehensive industry news and information, visit our website at irei.com and sign up for our free daily news alerts.
Welcome to the program. We're going to talk about the domestic and global economies and their outlook with Indy Karlikar, the Senior Managing Director of Global Research and Strategy at Principal Real Estate Investors. Indy is a member of the Principal Global Investors Economic Committee. He has been with the Principal Real Estate Investors team since 2013, and he's been a part of the industry since 2003. Now, recently, Indy has been focused on the long-term themes that he sees as the foundation for future economic growth, which he's prepared to talk with us about today. He joins us by telephone. Indy Karlikar, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Mike. It's great to be back with you again, and thanks again for having me on your show.
Indeed, having you back again. This is not Indy's first rodeo, although we haven't been on the phone together in doing a podcast for a few years, Indy. And your focus seems to have changed a little bit. The world has changed a lot in just a few years, and you've been monitoring those themes. So let's start there. From a thematic standpoint, what have you identified that investors and managers should be especially alert to as they make decisions going forward?
Thanks, Mike. You're right. A lot has changed, and a lot continues to change in the world. And we expect, you know, sometimes change to become a constant part of our lives and investment universes. So when we think back and we look forward at what might impact the world that we live in, the investment universe that we manage, and what we're trying to do for our clients, we try and step back and think about, you know, what are the big picture, long-term structural changes that will be important for us to follow and really try and be ahead of over the next, not just 2, 3, 4 years, but 10, 15, 20 years. So these are really big thematic structural changes that we think are going to be pretty critical in driving not only the global economy, but more importantly from our perspective, have an influence on real estate across the world. And it's we found it very, very fascinating to go through this exercise because, as you probably know and you're very aware of, most of us are so caught up in just living from the moment and focusing on the next 24 hours or 6 months or 12 months. It's hard to take a long-term strategic view. So we've done that, and we've come up with several themes that we think are going to be quite significant and play out in the coming years. On the surface, they seem to be very broad and large, and one can say pretty obvious. But as managers and investors, our job is to understand these themes and dissect them and find strategies that can drive positive results for managers and investors. And we've coined these themes, or given the acronym DIGITAL, to describe these long-term themes, and I'll obviously walk through them in some detail. The first one revolves around demographics, and demographics, I think, is, in our view, an obvious theme, an obvious structural change that's occurring across the world, especially in the developed world. And from our perspective, it offers multiple opportunities for investors. Often when we think about demographics, and certainly in the developed world, whether it's Europe, Japan, or the U.S., you think about baby boomers and the aging associated with demographics. That's clearly a factor. But when we do our analysis, when we've done our analysis, we've actually broken up the demographic opportunity set into 5 distinct cohorts. And if I break them out, they start right from the very beginning, what we call the silent generation, 1928, 1945. Obviously, the baby boomers, 1946, 64. Generation X, 65 to 1980. Millennials, 1981 to 97. And then Generation Z, which is 98 to present. And these are all distinct cohorts, and each cohort has some very interesting and divergent opportunities. I'm not going to go through the whole list, but just to give you a flavor, silent generation, often forgotten, but still quite an important constituency from our perspective. Collectively, they represent about 60 million people in Europe and the U.S. And the opportunities from a real estate perspective are clearly in the assisted living, care housing kind of space. You flip forward to the Generation X, which is actually a very large cohort in both the U.S. and Europe, almost 130 million between the two continents. The opportunities there are different. They're about e-commerce, they're about rental living, they're about residential opportunities, about hotels, creative space, et cetera, et cetera. So the demographic spectrum that we look at, I think, is something is going to be very, very important over the next decades and provide multiple opportunities for us to focus on as investors. I is for infrastructure. Infrastructure, I'm not going to belabor the point, except say that infrastructure is becoming an increasingly important factor when considering real estate investment opportunities. Markets, regulations that support infrastructure, we believe, will provide investors with the necessary real estate support markets that are necessary. For example, if you look at just Europe, Europe's got a fairly significant approach towards infrastructure investing. And as of December 2018, they have something called the Investment Plan for Europe with a value of almost 375 billion euros planned for different infrastructure investments. The idea behind targeting cities, markets that have strong infrastructure spending is that real estate is a clear beneficiary of that infrastructure spend. And real estate benefits when you have excellent infrastructure, whether it's your roads, whether it's your networks, whether it's your energy infrastructure, whether it's telecommunication, et cetera, et cetera. The third theme that we think is under attack now and still fairly convinced that will continue to be an important driver of long-term, not only global growth, but long-term demand for commercial real estate is globalization / urbanization. We firmly believe that we can find markets, target markets that are at the epicenter of the global movement of labor, capital, innovation, and trade. Investors should be able to build very durable long-term portfolios around that. Our last but not least, I would say, team that we've created within this digital format is innovation and technology. Now, those are obviously very big themes, very, you know, they've all been the buzzword for the last 10 or 15 years. But if we are able to harness some of the long-term structural changes that technology and innovation is driving in the way we work, in the way we live, in the way our lives are evolving, I think we need to provide some very interesting solutions for investors. Again, we think these are very, very large themes, but once you start dissecting the opportunities within these themes, you can find some really interesting opportunities. And maybe I'll end with a note on technology. We believe that the opportunity offered by technology-driven markets, or markets where technology is a big component of that economy, is significant. And it's significant not only for investors that are traditionally focused on the U.S., because if you think about technology and innovation, you think about Silicon Valley, you think about Boston. But now if you look across the world, the opportunity created by technology hubs is immense. The markets that are homes to different forms of technology are not only in the U.S., but they're in Asia, they're in Europe, and they span the gamut, everything from artificial intelligence to blockchain to fintech, cybersecurity to clean tech. So there is a very significant opportunity set, we believe, by tapping into the innovation and technology drivers that we think are going to be here for a very long time. So that's kind of an overarching thematic perspective, Mike, on the big drivers that we think as managers we want to be ahead of and take advantage of on behalf of our various investors.
So I was wondering why digital was, it was in all caps, it's actually an acronym. So you had mentioned demographics, infrastructure, globalization, technology, And did I leave anything else out there, Indy? Or
no, you've covered it.
The four big themes.
You've
okay.
covered
all of them. All of them in flux right now. Before we go forward, I'm curious what your thoughts are on the fact that we see U.S. and global growth slowing. At least it appears to be slowing. What is the chief culprit? Is there a particular dynamic at play that is causing this, or is this just as far as your research is concerned, the natural cycle of the economy, and it's time for a cool down period?
Yeah, Mike. I often get this question, and I've gotten this question increasingly over the last 3 or 4 years as we now entered the 10th year of our expansion. By the way, we are now close to achieving a record for the U.S. in terms of economic expansion since the Second World War. So I think we deserve a pat on the back for that. But my initial response is, look, expansions don't die old age. Right? It needs to be a catalyst that usually is responsible for a recession or a slowdown. But I think the more you think about where the U.S. is currently and what its historic cycle has been, I think we need to think about structural long-term factors that might be impacting the velocity of growth, not only in the U.S., but other developed markets, frankly, as well as cyclical factors that might be having an impact on where we are right now and might be what you're referring to in terms of a little bit of a slowdown that we have seen over the last 2 or 3 months. So if you look at the structural factors, I'm not going to spend too much time, but they are things that we should be cognizant of, not just us in the U.S., but certainly in Europe, certainly in Japan, certainly other developed markets. We're facing a demographic challenge, slowing growth in working age population. Our infrastructure, as you know, in the U.S. is pretty old, and there have been several attempts to get infrastructure spending going, but that doesn't seem to have gotten traction. That is certainly, I think, hindering growth. Consumers, if you look at what historically has driven the U.S., it's been consumers. But consumers are being, even though the labor market is extremely robust, as we know, consumer purchasing power has not grown as quickly, and wage growth has been fairly muted. So I think that's been a hindrance to why the U.S. economy has sort of had that stop-start kind of rhythm over this cycle. If you think about dovetail that with the cyclical factors that we think are playing out now, one is, from our perspective, why we're seeing this slowdown is really the ending of the fiscal stimulus. If you remember, the Trump administration passed a pretty significant fiscal package sometime in late 2017. That is basically burned off, and we're seeing as that burns off, the U.S. economy slow. No surprise, fully anticipated, but that's clearly been a drag on the U.S. economy as that has burned off. We are also seeing a skills mismatch. Even though unemployment is at record lows, a lot of highly skilled jobs are going unfulfilled. And that really has become a long-term as well as a cyclical challenge for the U.S. because the more high-paying jobs we have in the U.S., obviously the economy does better, but we are having a shortage of highly paid jobs, and I think that's becoming more of a cyclical drag as you go further into this cycle. And I think lower CapEx has become more of a challenge. We've seen, even though profitability for many corporates in the U.S. is still very high, instead of reinvesting that capital into productive exercises, we're seeing still a continued number of high level of stock buybacks, which is not, again, adding to any productive capacity to the economy. So there's these cyclical, I think, factors that are also now beginning to all combine to slow down the rate of growth in the U.S. And then obviously things that are a little less tangible, but I think obviously are preying on everyone's minds, are policy uncertainty, not only in the U.S., it's also, of course, China and the U.S. Making the headlines, the trade difficulties between the two countries. But don't forget, Brexit is hovering around the corner. troubles in Europe with Italy. So there is a sentiment that is possibly being impacted by policy uncertainty and politics in developed markets that is also perhaps taking a little bit of a toll, especially in the capital markets. And I think if you combine politics, uncertainty, and with some of the factors that I mentioned, it's leading to this slowdown in the U.S., certainly slowdown from 2018, but I don't want to sound too negative. We're still running at about 2%, maybe even a 2.5% annualized rate of growth, which again, given that we're in the 10th year of expansion, is not a bad place to be.
So let's stick with that globalization theme. That's one of your major themes. Is it fair to say that politics is playing a bigger role in the economy than it has in a long time? As you look around the world, we see populists and nationalists elected to the presidency of countries around the world. They've come to power. There's a lot of hostility towards immigrants. There's more of an attitude that it's basically anti-globalist. We have a lot of not just leaders, but the population that's rallying behind them that are anti-globalist and feeling as though these various trade deals and cooperative agreements that we have across continents are actually hurting them. So is globalization a foregone conclusion in the current rebellion against it, just a hiccup, or is there something more serious afoot?
Yeah, Mike, if you look at the arc of history in the 19th and 20th centuries, history's never been linear. Right? There have been several periods where we've seen nationalism and populism in many markets across the world. Obviously, we saw its most frightening form in the Second World War when nationalism assumed the form of Nazi Germany. So if you look at what's happening now in many markets across the world, it's not a new phenomenon. It's really a reflection of current sentiment, a sentiment at a point in time when populism has erupted as a protest against perceived inequality and perceived distribution of the benefits of globalization, the point that you were making. Now, if you look at the history of globalization in the modern era, let's just say since this post-Second World War period, it really started off with the growth of the miracle Asian economies and the growth of transnational conglomerates with their global supply chains. In the past 40 years, it's been trade, manufacturing services that have really driven the whole globalization phenomena. But if you go back in history, starting, you know, if you go back many millennia, many centuries, if you go back to trade routes between Europe and Asia, the Silk Route, the trade in spices between Asia and the West. Globalization has been the lifeblood of markets and countries. It has enabled nations to develop and use their comparative advantages. And so I hope, and perhaps this is the optimist in me, that what we are witnessing right now is a moment of time where populism is expressing itself through anti-globalization in some pockets of the world. And the next few years will probably mark a bit of a hiatus as countries realign their economies and markets, for sure. And I think underpinning some of this deep unease at globalization is obviously also a strategic game that's being played out between the U.S. and China at the future of world politics and how the world will shape out over the next 15, 20, 25, 30 years. But eventually, I suspect that global trade and services will realign and we will see globalization push forward, but perhaps in a different way, perhaps in a way that leads to a little bit more equitable distribution of wealth, in a way that there are no clear winners and losers, but more of perhaps a sharing of the benefits of globalization that really hasn't been evident over the last previous 40 years. So that's my hope and that's my expectation, Mike.
So let's take your infrastructure theme. Infrastructure needs to be retrofit here in developed economies such as the United States, and then you look around the world and developing economies need new infrastructure where it's in the trillions and trillions of dollars, the opportunity there. And I say opportunity, but at the same time, we've got governments and economies, the private sector, the public sector, laden with debt. And a lot of people are wondering how we're really even going to be able to pay for all of this. What about the high cost of new infrastructure and old infrastructure that needs to be retrofitted vis-a-vis these mountains of debt that a lot of people think are going to bring the global economy down?
I think the way forward is really a public-private partnership, Mike. And if you look at what's being tried in some other parts of the world where the public sector does not, A, have the resources, and B, or B, struggling with exactly the issue that you just highlighted, there has been an attempt to bring in private sector capital to help with some of the big challenges of infrastructure capabilities. And if you look at Australia, for example, or if you look at now parts of Asia, you are seeing some pretty interesting public-private type of partnerships that are being experimented to try and deal with this issue of infrastructure, or lack of infrastructure that you've highlighted. I think what's really interesting is that if you look at the private sector initiatives that are behind some of the infrastructure plans now being rolled out, and I think we'll see also roll out in Europe and the U.S. increasingly, is actually backed by some of the largest pension funds in the world. So it's almost like a full cycle. You know, we've seen, obviously, the most visible form of infrastructure is spending via the governments. But if you look at public-private partnerships, the private sector is actually also being funded by a form of the government, i.e. pension funds. So I think we'll have to see more public-private partnerships where private sector capital is provided with an adequate stream of return and finds a varied set of opportunities. I think that's the wonderful thing about infrastructure, as you probably know well, is infrastructure is a massive arena. It's not, you know, typically what you think about just being toll roads and bridges and ports, but it's much beyond that. So I think as it expands, the opportunity for public-private partnerships becomes, in my view, more meaningful.
So you're assuming then, you're feeling that there will be enough private money. I know a lot of private money sitting on the sidelines right now wanting to play in the architecture, or not architecture, but the infrastructure arena, and hasn't found that opportunity yet, and in part because the public-private partnerships, certainly here in the United States, have not moved along as quickly as was hoped. But also add to that there are certain forms of infrastructure that the private sector can't really play in, that there's really not any kind of profit to be had there. So, but you know, the numbers that you're looking at in terms of the amount of private money that could be applied to this issue or to this problem, it could be invested in it, is going to be sufficient then, provided governments put together good programs that make it remunerative.
I think infrastructure is going to be an ongoing challenge, to be honest, Mike, because, as you know, capital also has a required rate of return, as you've already identified. And there's some infrastructure projects that will, frankly, not be economically feasible for private sector investors. And that's where the national, state, municipal entities will have to step up and decide if it's worth their time to bridge that gap and fill that infrastructure need. So I think we'll have to just see how it evolves. And I think if we see some positive steps being made in the public-private partnership, the universe of what's possible does expand. And I think if private sector capital, as you know, it's very competitive out there right now with any kind of real asset, whether it's real estate, whether it's infrastructure. And if private capital feels that it can be given an adequate return and can be provided with enough opportunities, I think you'll see more private capital, frankly, push into the space. So I think it's a little bit of a chicken and egg situation. If there's not enough opportunities, then, you know, private capital doesn't sort of sits on the sidelines. And if the returns are too low, then private capital sits on the sidelines, as you've already mentioned. But I think if the world of opportunity is opened up a little bit more and different investment solutions are made available, I think then you'll see private sector capital become more interested. It's just logical to me in my, as I look through what the opportunities are.
Let's talk about your technology theme now. It's all very exciting, and we see how technology can create just tremendous efficiency and wealth. But at the same time, there are people who feel that the Achilles heel to future growth may be the continuing destruction of jobs by automation, robotics, and other technologies, artificial intelligence, and so on. What about technology stealing away more jobs than it creates? I mean, traditionally, we've always been able to grow the number of jobs. It seems that that could change, though, because technology is getting so powerful. It's able to do jobs that we didn't even fathom that it would be doing anytime sooner, or even in our lifetime. I mean, now we're talking about driverless vehicles and drone deliveries, and how long is it going to be before we have really kind of air taxi service? Just you know, the whole drone technology can take us places we really we're really talking about the Jetsons. It's quite amazing, and the technology is really pointing to a future where transportation doesn't necessarily need a driver anymore. That the computer can do very nicely. Thank you very much, and just get on board, and we'll take you where you're going. Just program in to your app where you need to be dropped off. What about technology? I got into transportation there, but technology affects so many different arenas.
Yeah, I mean, it's so common to hear or read about alarming stories and analyses on the coming destruction of jobs via technology. And I don't want to minimize the human damage done by technology or the price being paid by some skills across the world. No question. Technology has surpassed and supplanted many of the skills that you and I were used to over the last 20 years. And machines, whether it's computers, whether it's other forms of technology, have certainly become manifest in those positions. You know, technology is ruthlessly efficient, and we have to acknowledge that. I want to juxtapose that by saying, look at the U.S. We have seen technology become a central part of our lives over the last 20 years. Whether it's social media technology, whether it's hardware-related technology, whether it's artificial intelligence, the list goes on and on and on. And then you look at our labor market, and you see where we are. We are sitting at one of the lowest levels of unemployment in history. Not just 10 years, in history, 60 years, 50-year unemployment low. What does that tell you? It tells you that human beings can harness and take advantage of technology to meet their needs. And if you look at what you just mentioned, for example, driverless cars or driverless taxis, we need retooling of skills. I completely agree with that. But I don't think technology gains at the expense of humans. Who's going to program, who's going to manufacture, who's going to set these various technologies into play? Until artificial intelligence is at a level where it completely supplants human ability, which I hope obviously we don't get to, I think human beings are adaptable and they take advantage and harness technology. And technology becomes a close cooperative element of the human endeavor. I'm more optimistic, perhaps, than others that technology will become this apocalypse of destruction for jobs. As I said, I look at the U.S. and where we are right now. I look at the growth of technology and innovation over the last decade, and it gives me some comfort that our labor markets are pretty robust. We're still creating jobs, and that we seem to be doing so even as technology progresses. Now, I will say that one downside of technology, I think, is that it has kept them late on wages. And I think that is something that needs to be thought through more carefully.
So let's talk about demographics. There are aging populations in many of our leading economies, including Italy, Germany, Japan, China. The demographics in China say that it's going to be a quickly aging population very soon. The problem being that aging and shrinking populations, traditionally, that they've been poison to growth economies. We want young, robust workforces. Young people spend more money than older people or retired people. And perhaps, perhaps technology might change this dynamic. On the flip side, maybe if populations are shrinking, maybe we won't need so many jobs in the future. Maybe technology can either mitigate the impact of an aging economy, an aging population, and a shrinking population, in at least in economically advanced nations. What about that? What about the fact that we're seeing? And the other indication, Indy, is that as societies become wealthier, they have fewer children. I mean, having a lot of children used to be a form of social security. I mean, your children will take care of you in your old age. Now we have institutions that are set up for that, and we live in societies now where people start to think, I'm not so sure I want to. Well, the fact is birth rates drop in rich countries. They just do. They drop. There's all that to consider. So that's a long-winded question, but what about, what do you see demographics really doing in terms of investment opportunities?
Look, I think you're right, Mike. The demographics have become more challenging. It's ironic, that we've gone from talking about a population explosion to now a deficit of the population all within one generation. I think it shows you how quickly perceptions and realities can change. But no question, if you look at the world, if you look at projections for future growth, it certainly shows a plateauing and then a decline in demographics across the world. And that's partly a function of wealthier populations. We're not only in the developed markets, but in developing markets. And you're right, if having more children was a form of social security in developed markets, it's certainly the case in developing markets. But if you look at the continued increase in wealth across different generations, it means, from my perspective, that even though we do face the reality of an aging demographic, it's a reality of a wealthier aging demographic. And if I put on my real estate investment manager shoes, for me that means there are different opportunities up and down the age stack. Let me give you a great example, Germany. If you look at Germany, an aging wealthy, it's sort of the stereotype of an aging wealthy population, right? But I want to highlight the word wealthy. Germany has got an increasingly wealthy population that wants to retire in assisted living, care housing, independent senior living, et cetera, and that opportunity set did not really exist 20 years ago. It's after the Berlin Wall came down, after the German reunification happened, there's now been a huge surge in people above the age of 65 who want a higher quality of independent living. And we think that's a terrific market to be in as an investor. So that's an opportunity set that didn't exist because Germany was not such a big market, and the wealth in Germany has really now started to be appreciated as that generation has started to retire. So I think when we look at demographics, again, going back to the conversation when we started it, we got to view it, at least from where we see it, as a variety of investment opportunities that are going to be afforded to us. We can slice and dice the demographic outlook as we want it. And, we might want to do, for investors who are looking for more risky or more interesting, more challenging kind of opportunities, it may be the millennials and Generation Z they want to focus on with their creative, flexible offices, co-working, co-living spaces. So that's an opportunity. And for those investors who are looking for more of a coupon type of steady return stream, happy with bond-like returns or bond plus 200 basis points, it could be assisted living care housing. So I think you know, demographics are certainly challenging from a growth perspective, but from an investment perspective, I think there's some really interesting opportunities out there.
So we've talked about these themes. So what do we do with these themes? You're a real estate investor. You see these certain demographics going on. You see infrastructure opportunities, certain markets doing a better job of putting good infrastructure in, which supports real estate investing and so on. You see the technology globalization. So with this information, what kind of decisions do you think need to be made with regard to investing in real estate, whether it's in the United States or abroad?
I think what it helps certainly us to do is look beyond the short-term noise and volatility that is, you know, that is very much a part of our investment universes. You see that whether it's volatility in the capital markets, do you see it whether it's volatility through the political processes that we see unfolding across the world? By having these long-term drivers that we can focus on gives us the discipline to identify markets that have these characteristics. It gives us conviction that these markets are markets that are going to do really well over the long term, especially in a time when, as you probably know, pricing is quite rich in some markets. And this gives you the conviction that, yes, there is some turmoil. Yes, there's some instability. Yes, pricing is elevated in some markets. But if you believe that these long-term trends are going to play out in a meaningful manner, by identifying these markets, the cities across the world, which will benefit from these long-term trends, we think ultimately we're able to offer some really interesting and innovative solutions to investors who are looking to real estate to provide them with those answers to their questions. So whether it's funds, whether it's separate accounts, whether it's any kind of strategy, debt or equity, we believe that having these guideposts, long-term guideposts, will help us develop really long-term durable portfolios ultimately that will be and what investors are looking for as they look out not only over the next 2 to 3 years, but many of these investors are looking out 15, 20 years. So what we're really trying to do, Mike, is to develop a set of convictions, a set of guideposts that will help us generate these long-term portfolios that match what our investors are looking for in terms of their real estate solutions.
Our guest has been Indy Karlikar, the Senior Managing Director of Global Research and Strategy at Principal Real Estate Investors. And Indy, it's good to catch up with you again. You've obviously been doing a lot of research. I appreciate you taking the time and going around the globe with us.
My pleasure, Mike. As always, it's great to be on a podcast with you, and certainly appreciate the opportunity to have this fantastic dialogue with you.